I saw a cartoon this morning which seems to speak very well to the dilemmas the planet is facing at this time. It was a picture of a wild bear, a big, you know, the kind that you don't want to meet in the forest. And he was sitting in a campground in the forest at a picnic table, and he had his paws folded and he was sitting like this. And the caption said, Muslims, Christians, Jews, atheists, men, women, young, old, gay, straight, they all taste like chicken. It's always dangerous to start with a joke because then you have to try to figure out how it all fits together, but it actually does. Yesterday, in our glorious 8-hour meditation, many of you were here, and those of you who weren't are bearing the residual vibrations. And we all carry them for a whole year, in fact. We heard a Christmas greeting that Swami had given a few years ago, 5 minutes or so. It was from 5 or 6 years ago. And in it, Swami just states categorically two things. First, he quotes Master as saying that when the three wise men came to visit Jesus in the manger, Master had declared that those three wise men were Sri Yukteswar, Lahiri, and Babaji, who are three gurus in this line of gurus. This is a disciplic succession, master, disciple, master, disciple. Yogananda had also talked about this same lineage stretching back to Krishna, and who knows how much farther back than that. And Swamiji, at one point, when this message was written, was around the time he was working on the book Revelations of Christ, which is not really a commentary on the Bible the same way that the Bhagavad Gita is, but it's the essence of what Master had to say about the original Christianity of Jesus. And Swamiji said that the more he worked on that book, in other words, the more deeply he attuned himself with the consciousness of Christ, the more he became persuaded inwardly that the same soul that had incarnated as Yogananda had also incarnated as Christ. He said they were the same person. He could feel that they were the same person. And that was the obvious question. If Sri Yukteswar Lahiri and Babaji are coming to pay homage at the manger, who's lying in the manger? And then Swamiji also commented that he had asked Master, were you Jesus in a former incarnation? Master's answer was an interesting one. It was, what difference would it make? When I had asked Swamiji in a certain context commentary, Yogananda had been equivocal about the question of the Immaculate Conception. He referred to Joseph as the father of Jesus, and then parenthetically he said, in a human or perhaps in a divine way, close parentheses, and then went on, said nothing else. I said, Swamiji, what is this? I mean, this little parenthetical remark. Swami said, some things even Master wouldn't take on. And Swami's comment, you know, why didn't Master make a point of it if in fact it was true, is that it would have distracted from absolutely everything else. Nobody would have heard any other word he said. It would have just been a huge controversy. Is this the reincarnation of Jesus? There was a man, apparently, in New York, who called himself Father Divine. And in the 30s or the 40s, he was quite the thing in New York City. And he wrote to Yogananda and suggested that they combine forces because he thought that that could be a really powerful combination, Father Divine and Swami Yogananda. And he said Father Divine used to sit in his sanctuary, and he had sort of a throne, and on top of it there was a little sign that said God, and that's where he would sit. And then he came under some kind of legal challenge, and in the middle of the case against Father Divine, the judge died. And Father Divine said, I hated to do it. But so there's a lot that goes on in so-called religious life that is caused more for amusement than for inspiration. And the reincarnation of Jesus is certainly one of those. Because people want to claim it. In the 60s and the 70s, when there were a lot of so-called gurus, just every time you turned a corner, there was a new one. And the Yoga Journal was just beginning then, and it was the vehicle for all of the conversation about these things. And there was one well-known teacher who has since absolutely just faded into a complete non-oblivion in that respect. And he posted his resume, which was the things he did in this life and then the things he'd done in previous lives, including all the avatars he had been previously. And he'd been Rama, he'd been Krishna, he'd also been Jesus. He just listed them like you would list, you know, from this year to this year I was this, from this year to this year. Oh my. Somebody said once that Americans were so gullible on the spiritual search. It was like some Indian, like if an Indian man had just moved to America from never having been exposed to anything and was watching late night television and saw some used car salesman telling you that you've got to rush right down to, you know, to Honest Henry's used car lot to get the best deal of the century. Now is the time when you have to come and buy the car. And then the poor guy just rushes out to buy the car because he feels like he has no choice. That's kind of like the way, especially young Americans, some of them inspired by psychedelic drugs, were behaving towards so-called claims. I mean, there has to be some discrimination. However, when Swami Kriyananda says, I'm inclined to believe that Jesus and Master were the same soul, that's a wholly different statement. But you have to then ask your question, what is the point? I mean, one of the points is to say, well, did you notice we're the best, and we've been the best for a long time, and that everything that we do has the imprinter of this and that. I mean, that is, well, it all tastes like chicken, remember? It just all comes down to the same. There's an expression in India, which I'd heard for many years, which I'd never really quite understood. I heard Swami explain it on a recording. It says, it's a blessing to be born into a religion, but it's a misfortune to die in one. And I've heard that, and I've always nodded sagely like, oh yeah, sure, I have no idea what it means, but I would just pretend that I knew what it meant. But Swamiji explained it very simply. It's fortunate to be born into a household that loves God and that will raise you no matter what form they're raising you in. So from childhood, your natural spiritual feelings are encouraged. That's good karma. Of course, sometimes the nature of that is such that you repudiate it later, but to really be born into a house of devotion is a positive thing. But what Swamiji was explaining, that to choose and to say this is my religion, implies for almost everyone that in some way, of course, mine is a little better than all the others, or a little more true. Or isn't it, you know, people become so broad-minded, but what they really are is they're just tolerant with a little bit of sympathy that, well, it's really too bad that, you know, when we all get to heaven, you're not going to be there. But, and you know, you're sincere in your misguided beliefs. So there's the implication that if I am this, I'm this because I've looked them all over and this is the best one. And the misfortune is not to grow past that in the course of a lifetime. In the course of a lifetime, we may start by identifying our spirituality with a certain name, with a certain set of rituals, whatever it may be. But ultimately, what we really have to understand is that it's God playing in all these different ways, and it's the same spirit no matter where we see it. And Swamiji, and even Master himself, why would Master say that these same gurus were there at the birth of Jesus? Why would Swami say that Master himself was present at that moment? What we're talking about is we're talking about this endless cycle of the divine's concern for our salvation. Swamiji has raised the question, just engineering backwards, just starting back from how closely associated this line of masters seems to be with various important historical events or other spiritual movements in our known history. He said, perhaps a group of masters has certain responsibility for a planet. You know, it's just like, maybe that's what this is really all about, that on certain planets, certain great souls take responsibility. Just like there's certain countries or certain cultures, there's just certain avatars who return again and again and work with it over a very long period of time. In Autobiography of a Yogi, it talks about how Babaji is concerned with the very, very long-term development of this planet and these civilizations and these souls. Us is what we're talking about. Because certainly it takes more than one incarnation for us to find our way. Yes, Master does say we don't always come back to the same planet, to use his own words, because then we would find out too quickly, because it would all be too familiar to us. And yet at the same time, many of us feel a bigger sense of identity than just with this one particular period of history or this one particular manifestation of these masters. We feel like we've walked this path before. And so how long is the cycle? Master came this time and talked about the unification of East and West, the restoring of original Christianity and the original teachings of Krishna and showing their unity. What could give them greater unity than it's the same teaching over and over again presented by the same souls, really, and I have to say it, to some of the same ones of us who are just step by step learning to grow beyond religion into true spirituality. When we've been asked, you know, on your passport forms or on other forms, sometimes it asks for your religion. Swami just call yourself a self-realizationist. And that's not a religion. Self-realizationist is a state of consciousness. And that is our spiritual commitment. Our spiritual commitment is not really to anything, not to the building, not to the name, not to the name tag that we wear. It's to the process of self-realization. There's a very interesting aspect, and it's highly related to the three wise men coming from the East, being masters of the East and coming to the manger to see the baby Jesus, because Master also states, and others have corroborated this now, this is not merely his own statement, that the lost years of Jesus, the so-called lost years, the 18 years, he went to India. Master even says it more emphatically. His family wanted him to get married. That's what Master stated. He was of the age when they wanted to arrange a marriage for him, so he left. He just left for the Himalayas, literally. And he went and spent time in the Himalayas with the same masters who had visited him. And then he traveled all over India. And particularly there are stories told about him going to Puri, where that they were very dogmatic in their approach to spirituality, and Jesus got in a lot of trouble there trying to get them to be more broad-minded. The Jagannath Temple in Puri is still very known for being so dogmatic and narrow-minded. They won't let you in unless you're a Hindu. They just absolutely won't. When our tour group was there and our tour guide, who was very much on our side, found out that we weren't going to be permitted in because we weren't Hindu, he went to the board. He thought that was outrageous. He said, I've been traveling with these people for 15 years. These are more Hindu than most of the people born in this country. He just thought he could persuade them. He came back to us and he said, never in 100 million years will they let you in that temple. There's just no way. Well, apparently it was the same when Jesus was there and he didn't get any farther with it. But he actually was 18 years in India. He was 3 years in the life that we know of him. And here's another fascinating fact, which I just love. This is from esoteric research done by a spiritual man named Bishop George. I believe you can look it up. Bishop George was formerly Swami Nirmalananda. He was a friend of Kriyananda's. He's an eccentric man, but he's the real deal, so I believe him. And he has all this research about Thomas, the Apostle Thomas, because the Apostle Thomas' assignment was to go back to India. And Christianity was carried to India by Thomas right after Jesus' crucifixion. That's where Thomas went. And he went to the south of India. And there's a huge Christian element in India because of Thomas. And his body is in Chennai in this huge cathedral there. It's a very, very powerful place that I've been to. And interestingly, you see, that assignment to Thomas was given directly by Jesus. This is how this is what Father George's research says. That after Jesus died when the apostles were trying to decide what they should do when they got together to decide. Thomas wasn't included because he already had assignment from Jesus. And he left for India and never came back, completely on his own. And originally, you see, what Thomas taught was Sanatana Dharma, which is he taught eternal truth. He didn't teach a sectarian approach to religion in which now you're finally saved because Jesus has finally been born, and all you poor saps for thousands of years ahead of time never had a chance, and everybody who doesn't accept him now doesn't have a chance. I mean, my religion is the right religion. What, that's not what Jesus taught. Jesus was Indian, and Thomas went back to finish what Jesus had started. Ironically, and he was very powerful and very successful and established Christianity for hundreds of years. Then I believe it was first the Portuguese, perhaps then the Spanish, came in, and they obliterated all traces of Thomas Christianity and replaced it with Roman Christianity. So it became completely Roman. By that point, it had become the church and no other. And all of that work of Thomas just went away. But it was this effort, east and west, east and west. And what does Master say that his goal is? It's time for east and west to unite again. I mean, what does that mean? Does that mean we're supposed to sing Jaya Shiva Shankara, Om Ganesha, Om Ganesha? You know, is that really what that means? Or is what we're talking about is that it's a blessing to be born into a religion and a misfortune to die in one? What could be more extreme from some people's point of view than this idea of Christianity and this, what people consider the paganism, the idolatry of Hinduism, neither of which is really the truth of it. The truth is what they call Sanatana Dharma, which is self-realization, which is that we are here for one purpose, and that purpose is to grow closer to God. And no one can define that for you. No one can give you a dogma and promise you that it's going to happen, or excommunicate you if you don't cooperate, or if you violate somebody else's concept. It's only and always between you and God. There was a woman in our community, and when she died relatively young of cancer, Swami made the interesting comment at her astral ascension ceremony. He said, only a little bit of her expressed through the body and the personality that she had. He said most of her she kept internally and in the spirit. And her sister said afterwards, he was referring to Bella, and her sister Maria said later, he said, how did Swami know that? Because they'd grown up together and she was aware of that. I'd meditated on that a lot because it's a very interesting thought. You know, we're so accustomed to putting forth our energy and defining ourselves and each other by what we see coming forth. How sensitive are we? What do we really know about each other? What do we really see? In Helen's reading today, when she talked about share with God everything, even a passing fancy, until you're talking to God sometimes and pretty soon you're talking to God all the time. We're always talking to each other. We have this compulsion. We need somebody to hear our thoughts. We need somebody to talk to. We need to be able to express like this. Yes, we do, in fact. But what if the company we were keeping with the divine was so dynamic and so alive in our lives that that communion was always happening without the necessity ever to put it into outward speech? There was such a sweet story about St. Teresa of Avila, who was so often called from her cell to the parlor, as they called it in the parlance of the convent there, because she was very well known and she was very charming and had been from a very prominent family, and many people would come to call on her, and it was very tiresome for her to be called from her little cell and have to go into the parlor. And she would often say, you'll have to excuse me, there's a guest waiting for me in my cell. And the guest that was waiting for her was Jesus himself, who would manifest to her and she would talk to him. And it was so much more of a vivid and important relationship. What necessity was there to just pour her thoughts out to people who could never really understand who she was. Now, whether that communion is with Christ, that communion is with Krishna, that communion is with Master, with Divine Mother, however you feel it, the essence of our life and the only purpose of our lives is that communion. And if these masters incarnate again and again, you know, Judaism, which was the one true religion of the time, Jesus was a messenger to the Jews. And that's a complicated spiritual issue. But Judaism was crashing on the rocks of power and money in the hands of a corrupt priesthood. And as Swami described it, talking about the personality of Jesus and what he was really like, and how much that personality was like Master, who had also incarnated as William the Conqueror and as Ferdinand III, also a warrior in Spain who fought to keep Spain Christian against the invasion of the Moors. Who knows why, but the Christianity was an important, it was the closest to Sanatana Dharma they had to hold it. And that's also what happened when he was William. He established monasteries. He helped establish Christianity as Sanatana Dharma in that country. But in those incarnations, he had to do it as a general. And Jesus was that kind of a man. He had to, as Swami said, he had to wrest the truth of Judaism away from this corrupt priesthood almost violently. You know, he was constantly in argument and in confrontation and upsetting the tables of the money changers and accusing the Pharisees of hypocrisy in this tremendous battle in order to bring the truth back. And he was teaching nothing but true Judaism at the time. I have come to fulfill the prophets, not to deny them. It was only later, when the establishment that was Judaism managed to close the doors against this new sect of Judaism, that in fact it became something else. But it was always the same message. And here we are again. This beautiful baby is born. This exquisite sweetness is offered to us. And all of the Bible speaks of, and because the Bible was this battle, to bring it back to our inner reality. Be ye therefore perfect, even as our Father in heaven is perfect. After I am gone, I will send to you the Comforter. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. Where is the kingdom of God? It is not found outside of ourselves. It is found within. This was the message that little babe, that was the divine love to which he came to persuade us. And here we are again. Look at the world we live in. I mean, really, look at the values of this world. Look how far we've wandered from the purity of the love of Jesus, from the pure essence of Judaism, from the pure essence of every true expression of Sanatana Dharma. Look how far we've wandered into such fields of materialism and corruption and misunderstanding. It's truly tragic and would end in tragedy, except the masters come again and again and again and again. For one reason, for us. Sister Gyanamata said to Master, "I know you came for a world-changing mission," she said, "but I like to think you came for me." And there's nothing selfish in that. In fact, that's just exactly how we should feel. When we see the little baby Jesus on the altar, when we see him brought in, as we do on Christmas Eve so triumphantly with so much devotion, don't think he came to save the world. He came for you. He came for me to persuade us back to our only home in infinite love. God bless.